Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I was super happy to have Jeff Cruzy. Jeff is a partner at 7% Ventures and is a seasoned VC with a strong background in deep tech. Jeff has held roles across banking, climate tech, as well as having co-founded a startup in the AR, VR and computer vision space. He played a pivotal role at Seraphim Space Investment, deploying significant capital and co-founding the AWS Space Accelerator before joining 7% in 2023. In today's episode, we talk about whether or not software's hit a natural limit.
I think in a lot of areas of software, we've kind of hit limits in terms of the functionality, usability, or what we want it to do.
Whether the UK tries to de-risk too much in venture and has a US VC community invested in tech that was physically impossible.
The claims that they were making about what they're going to produce in the future is physically impossible.
Can investors corner the market and create monopolies? And are UK numbers in VC distorted by SEIS and EIS? We talk about rent seeking versus value production in the UK.
You're building a business that's creating a product or a service that people are paying a lot of money for, and they keep coming back to you. And that's producing some kind of economic good.
And whether or not we really need another neobank. Is the US VC industry demonstrating cartel-like behavior?
If we have that much capital consolidated under such a small number of people, them having sort of rein on those technology decisions concerns me.
And we talk about when mythology breaks reality in VC. And Jeff's contrarian conviction, it doesn't make sense to send people to Mars. Let's get straight into it. Great to have you here in the studio, Jeff. We're going to get into some pretty interesting stuff, I think, during this conversation. So the first one that I want to talk to you about is this whole kind of deep tech evolution, right? So you've focused on deep tech throughout your career. Why do you think it's become cool only now? Right. And based on what you're currently seeing, how do you see or think about the approaches to deep tech investment here in the UK versus in the US?
Yeah. So I think deep tech underlies a lot of technology and has for a long, long time. I think it's becoming more of a popular focus for investment today because I think in a lot of areas of software, we've kind of hit limits in terms of the functionality, usability, or what we want it to do. And that can also explain why we're seeing, you know, the boom in AI right now as well. But what's that? What that's doing is lowering the barriers to entry there, and making it very simple for anybody to get involved very, very quickly. I mean, you can prototype an app now at, you know, a tiny fraction of what you could years ago. So, anyways, and that's what I was kind of referring to with software eating itself and AI and all that. And so we need new paradigms to address things like the AI compute demand question and why people are looking at new energy sources or more advanced energy, cleaner energy sources for data centers and whatnot. And so I think it's just sort of a natural evolution. I always thought about it like in regards to, I use the iPhone as an analogy, actually. We had the BlackBerry with the hard-coded keyboard. Then we got a touch screen and all of a sudden functionality exploded. And then that hardware begat a whole new generation of applications, a whole new generation of software. So I've always thought about it in this sort of like forward looping cycle.
I think the iPhone analogy is an interesting one. I was using smartphones back in the early 2000s, but they were like Microsoft Windows smartphones. So they always existed. The problem, the difference was that Apple, I guess, built an ecosystem that allowed for experimentation with their hardware, right? And then to your point around software eating itself or hitting its kind of natural limits, you have to remember, I guess, that software doesn't exist without hardware, right? We forget about the hardware, but the hardware is where the software lives, right? Without that, it means nothing. You know, you could have a text document with a ton of code on it, but unless you have a machine to input that code into, like, it's not going to do anything. And how do you think, I guess, you know, because the UK, from what I'm seeing, you know, has definitely started looking at deep tech quite significantly. And I kind of use a relatively broad framework to think about deep tech. For me, it's sort of life sciences, medical devices, but it's equally hardware, spaceships, drones, you know, military applications, and anything I think that is very naturally R&D intensive. That's kind of the way I think about it. In the UK and Europe generally, I'm not sure that we have a core consensus on, or not necessarily even a consensus, but I don't think we have, competitive advantage necessarily in any one of those fields. Although the scientific kind of research led stuff, certainly in the UK is one that, you know, you could point to. The US, on the other hand, seems to have gone very kind of deep down the space tech and military applications. But where do you see the differences? Like, how does the US approach versus UK?
I would say fundamentally the biggest difference between the US and the UK in terms of startup and VC really is just sort of a basic mindset. And I've always described it as, you know, abundance versus scarcity mindset. Where, you know, what I would see a lot of times in the UK is, you know, risk aversion, trying to de-risk constantly, which is just another way of saying we're going to lower expected return somehow, I think. So I don't think that's the right way to approach VC because it's an inherently risky asset class. There's going to be risk involved, and the whole point is being able to clearly identify it and manage it moving forward, not mitigate it necessarily.
Yeah, so the US, I guess, has that much more broad, I mean, I guess, the old adage or whatever that, you know, Silicon Valley will fund a pitch deck, New York will fund revenue, the UK will fund profits, right? Like, it kind of comes, I think, to some extent out of the fact that venture was born in the US and came out of, you know, Trader Asade, all of that sort of stuff, you know, Fairfield Semiconductors, et cetera. And we tend to forget the UK is, you know, as an industry, is probably only like 15, 20 years old at most. Like, it, like probably since 2010 is when really it's kind of come into its own. And so maybe it's still finding its feet, but it's grown out of the private equity industry here in the UK, which is obviously fundamentally about minimizing risk as far as possible. And the UK kind of has that whole financial sort of background, if I can put it that way, and old school thinking. Like, you know, even if you look at today's sort of industry splits in the US, in the 1900s, it was predominantly industry manufacturing, et cetera. And the UK was quite similar. If you fast forward to today, you know, 50-60% is tech versus the UK, it's still financial services, maybe some manufacturing, but service industry, right? So we haven't taken that leap from those kind of all, you know, all industry 2.0 or industry 1.0 kind of scenarios into essentially, you know, the information technology age in the same way. And I wonder whether that is both as a result of that risk aversion that you allude to, or whether there is a lack of understanding at the founder level around how ambitious they can be.
I think it's probably both to some degree, you know, because the founders oftentimes are informed by the investors and, yeah, and so on and so forth. So you kind of have this vicious cycle at some point. Yeah. And, you know, I think it can be broken, but I think people need sort of a guiding light, a good example that they can look at to give them confidence that, oh, yes, we probably need to have larger seed rounds, for example.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, we're just going to underfund competitive companies to Americans that are way better funded, and it's just not going to end well.
But we have that problem in any case because we don't have enough later stage capital to keep those businesses funded, so they naturally either head off to the US or get acquired by US companies, right?
Yeah, and I would say, at least from my perspective, because I, you know, I was here in 2020 and 2022, it seems like it's starting to accelerate. Actually, I think founders are starting to leave earlier and earlier for the US.
Yeah.
And just opt out entirely.
Yeah. That feels like it could be problematic, I think, because one of the things that predicates kind of the VC ecosystem is that you have founders and or teams with great outcomes that recycle either their capital or knowledge in the ecosystem. But if they are all heading to the US, they have Tom Blomsfeld, who's joined YC. You know, you've had other high profile kind of tech entrepreneurs leaving the UK or saying that they're going to leave the UK. It sets up that mindset that you can't be successful here, or you can only be successful up to a point here, and then you have to go elsewhere. I mean, this is probably not a problem that you and I are going to solve on this podcast, certainly. But yeah, it feels like that you know, I always say capital. So talent and capital follow each other. So if there is a flight of talent, the capital will also, you know, go with it. And then you have an even bigger problem.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, but I don't think all is lost at this point, because I do think there's a world-class brain trust here in the UK.
Yeah.
It just needs to be managed a whole heck of a lot better than it currently is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you're listening, Kia and Rachel, please. Maybe, please. Okay, we're going to move on to a slightly different but similar sort of topic, right? So when you and I have spoken in the past, you'd mentioned frustrations with the US VC ecosystem. So let's not pretend that the UK is the only place with problems, right? But a lack of first principles thinking out there. So you went as far as to say you believe this has set the industry back by a decade. So what changes do you, well, first of all, can you kind of expand on what you mean by that, and also what are the changes that you think are needed to kind of address this?
I'll use a US example just to illustrate what I'm talking about, but you know, I think Magic Leap is a great example of this. They were the company based out of Florida that was trying to build an AR headset, raised, you know, billions of dollars to do that, never really put anything out that anybody wanted. I believe part of the reason they raised so much money was because people didn't really understand the technology they were actually investing in.
Got it.
And had they actually talked to somebody that was intimately familiar with the optical layouts of these headsets, they probably would have told you that, you know, the claims that they were making about what they're going to produce in the future is physically impossible. Like, it breaks physics.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm not sure this is the right company people should be pouring billions of dollars into, but, you know, that's the job of the VCs at the end of the day. To make well-informed investment decisions. And it's just clear to me that these kinds of things happen over and over again, and it looks more like a sales job than it does technology investing.
That kind of, I mean, to me, that sounds like a couple of things. You had, so A, yes, first principles thinking, like actually stepping back and understanding the technology. And I think there's, that also brings up the question of generalist versus specialist VCs. And, you know, I think, well, specialist VCs always point to data saying that specialist VCs are outperform, whereas generalists equally find their own data. But there is an element of that. So, like, can you deeply understand the technology you're investing in? But then the second problem, and I think we saw a lot of this in 2021, 22, back in the 20, I guess, of FOMO and largely kind of party rounds where actually throw everything out the window. If it's hot, it's hot, and you've got to be in that deal. Do you think that has been part of the problem as well? Like, do those things go hand in hand?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, you know, FOMO can be synthesized or engineered in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
I think that's oftentimes a way to get people to bend on their criteria of investment, or, like you said, throw it out entirely. So I think it can be problematic, but, you know, fact of the matter is there's more than one way to win as a startup, right? And, you know, if you go back to, like, Peter Thiel's 0 to 1, you know, I think he was sort of accurate in saying that, you know, that there's more than one way to win, and, you know, illustrates how one of the ways is if you corner all the capital, you can become the default de facto winner.
Yeah.
And you'll figure out how to win later, but because everybody's already written their one check to that industry segment, that's it.
Yeah, so it's first mover advantage, essentially. Or
I wouldn't even say, like, first mover, because you know, like, for example, like Anduril's, like, I mean it's not like they're building their border security stuff in large scale anymore.
Right.
That's what they moved first on, but then they went out and cornered all the capital and became a defense company.
Yeah, so that's what I mean, not first mover from the company's perspective, but almost first mover from the investor's perspective.
Yes. Well, yeah. And I think that could also explain some of these sort of abnormally large first rounds we're seeing sometimes, you know, like $40 million plus.
Yeah. Well, certainly in AI, right? Like that's the, like, if you can pump enough capital, create, you know, but this is the thing. Capital as a moat was a thing, I think, 5-6 years ago. It doesn't feel like we're still in that stage of capital being a moat. Although deep tech may be, well, certainly in software, I think that's the case. In deep tech, capital still is a moat, right, to some extent.
I think it can be, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because ultimately, you know, again, if I think about the sort of businesses that we're talking about, they are R&D heavy. They require large pools of capital, A, to do the, you know, the scientific research at the beginning, and then to actually build the hardware or product or whatever it might be. I mean, like that costs money. Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, I think I was talking to you earlier, you know, about a green tech business that is going to, you know, requires $500 million to get off the ground. Right now, not many people are going to be able to raise $500 million. Right. So capital definitely is a moat in those sort of industries. Mm-hmm. But this comes back to that same question that I asked earlier. I'm like, does the UK and Europe have deep enough pools of capital to be able to support those sort of businesses?
I don't personally think so. I mean, I think what you pointed out earlier, you know, there's sort of a shortage of follow-on capital beyond pre-seed and seed and Series A mostly. I think it's a huge problem because, you know, it'll strand companies that, you know, built a strategy out here, or force them to leave. And that's just going to like play out pretty poorly in a lot of cases for both founders and investors.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I do think now is a time that the right team could really capitalize on this market dynamic, because, I mean, there's no shortage of companies to go after, and you kind of have your pick from Series A onwards.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, hopefully there's some people out there raising those funds right now.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. I'm like, we live in hope. I think, you know, because I spend a lot of time with emerging managers are finding it harder, obviously, at the moment to raise, certainly Fund One, possibly even Fund Two, depending on what performance of Fund One has been, and depending on when they raised Fund One, obviously that can vary quite a lot. But, you know, this also goes back to something else we were talking about. If you're investing at pre-seed seed, does it make sense to raise large funds? And therefore, you know, are there enough the late stage investors, they're the guys raising those larger funds. But we're seeing a lot of those larger funds are coming out of the US into the UK, Europe, because A, prices are cheaper, mm-hmm. entry points are lower, and costs are, let's face it, a lot lower here that versus in the US, certainly for talent as an example. So I, you know, again, the question, I wonder whether Europe kind of says, well, it's fine, the US is there, there's enough capital out there, we don't need to worry about it, which worries me in itself. And this is the other kind of question within this question is, you know, are we too reliant on state capital, state LPs? And you and I were talking about this earlier. And does that cause kind of friction in the market as well?
I think it can distort the market somewhat, for sure. You know, if we're talking about EIS and SEIS investors, I think, first of all, including those in the conversation about VC needs to stop, because they're not actual VCs. They don't fund a lot of companies that are typically venturable. They're looking for tax breaks. It's not the same thing in any way, shape, or form.
Incentives are different.
Yeah, totally. So I think once we can kind of remove that from the conversation, any kind of stats we're looking at, then we can have a more sober conversation about what's actually happening in VC in the UK.
Yeah.
Because my guess is that it's not as fertile of ground as we think it probably is right now. And so that could include taking measures to remove that kind of government funding.
Yeah. And if you actually then see where the problem is, you can start thinking about how you fix it rather than just assuming that it's all fine because the numbers are distorted.
Yeah. The expectation there, I think, is like, if that's going to be such a huge part of the LP money in the UK, then it's expected that the UK is going to have some kind of winner. But like, we just don't have that ecosystem to create those kinds of companies yet. And so I think it's even just sort of ahead of itself at this point. So,
yeah. A question for you, right? So obviously in the UK, you have the British Business Bank. In Europe, you have the EIF. Is there an equivalent in the US?
No, not really. They don't really have like a sovereign wealth fund there.
Right. So, I mean, I kind of knew the answer to that question. So sorry, bit of a leading question. No. Do you think that has an impact? Do you think that those sovereign funds are again either distorting the market or creating negative incentives as a result of being in the market.
Yeah, I think when they kind of try to put bounds on the investments themselves is when it starts to really distort things. You know, I've worked at firms where we took BBB money, and it can get very frustrating because you can be looking at an amazing company that you know is going to produce a return, but because they don't have anybody in the UK, you kind of got to go find something else. And a lot of times it's suboptimal. So it's just, it's not helpful in producing returns, honestly. Like it's another way of just capping returns.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird because there's two sides to that, right? It stifles innovation on one side because, you know, we complain about the fact that US firms are capitalizing on UK companies, right, which essentially end up going to the US because the market is bigger, there's more capital, et cetera, et cetera. They'll end up listing there because the listings, you know, tend to do better there than they do in the UK, Europe, et cetera. Mm. So we complain about that, but at the same time, we have a protectionist attitude almost towards, right, towards that early stage investing as well. I want to move on to kind of a topic that I'm fairly vocal about. It's probably the best way of putting it. And that's kind of rent seeking versus value production, right? So like the current tech landscape, we've seen a lot of businesses that aren't necessarily creating a novel product or trying to creatively kind of upend existing business models or businesses and verticals, you know, that whole kind of disruptor mindset. And rather than that, they're kind of finding avenues to extract value from market inefficiencies, right? Which is essentially rent seeking, right? So how do you differentiate between company that is rent seeking versus value producing or, you know, value accretive? And what impact does that distinction have on the venture ecosystem, particularly in the UK?
I'm typically looking whether or not, I mean, you can typically identify it by whether or not the value is aggregating at that point or it diminishes each turn, or not diminishes, but you know, you start over each turn. And so, you know, with rent seeking, you just get a new renter. In value aggregation, because you know you're building a business that's creating a product or a service that people are paying a lot of money for, and they keep coming back to you, and that's producing some kind of economic good. Rent seeking. You know, I think a lot of fintech is just rent seeking technology, basically. And the other thing about that is, you know, it's typically not super competitive either. Mm. So they're not the kinds of companies you typically want to look at as a VC that's going to give you some kind of ability to shoulder out competition. Mm. It can become overly competitive in those points.
Yeah. So, I mean, the obvious example of that is kind of neobanking. Like, I work in finance, right? We're CFOs. We come across a lot of neobanks, and I kind of look at them like, okay, so you got this benefit and that benefit. But like at the end of the day, I want a banking service that holds my money, gives me my money when I want my money, allows me to send money to people that I want to send money to, and allows me to receive money. And yeah, okay, integrate with this and you know, work, play nicely with my accounting system, whatever it is, right? But a bank is a bank is a bank. And I never quite understood why, like, we just saw, I don't know how many, a dozen, 50, 100 neobanks. Like, and I remember one of the guys I used to work with, he was actually worked with me in my business as a marketer. And one of the other businesses he was supporting was creating a neobank. And the whole kind of proposition was, we're a neobank, but we can also do your incorporation if you are like an Eastern European company that is trying to set up in the UK. So we basically can sort out that whole stack. And I'm like, okay, but then what are you? Are you a bank or are you some sort of corporate services kind of business? And actually, what is the volume there? And, you know, okay, fine. One might be a hook into the other. But at the end of the day, then if you're building a bank, what is it that differentiates you as a bank? And like, frankly, as a bank, there aren't many ways that you can differentiate, at least from my perspective. Like, I'm just sort of sat there going, okay, it's kind of a bit yawn to see these battles between the neobanks, because it's just like, well, you're a bank.
I kind of have a theory on that, actually.
Yeah, go on.
So I agree. Like, there's a ton of banks that are marginally different from one another. It doesn't really change our daily lives all that much.
Yeah.
However, I do remember in South America when, I don't know, this must have been 8 years ago, maybe, we started seeing all these neobank, digital neobanks emerged in South America, I would argue in that part of the world, in a lot of areas, it had a ton of value.
Yeah, unbanked.
Yeah, because people would still buy stuff at layaway at the local corner shop and things like that. So yeah, it really provided them a lot of value. But we already have that in the UK. And I think maybe there was this misunderstanding that they could replicate what they saw in South America and just like do it over here. And you know, some of those firms that invested in those neobanks are here in London, so it wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, there's a couple of points. I mean, we've talked about it on the podcast before, but you know, the example I always give is M-Pesa in Africa and, you know, East Africa, especially. Like, yeah, that made sense. Like, okay, you have people at the margins of the economy, subsistence earners, cash earners, and they needed a way to send and receive money. They're not likely going to be able to open a bank account. They don't have like a fixed abode. You know, they don't tick the boxes that you need to as a bank. So yeah, being able to send money on your telephone with your phone, like, huge amount of sense. Over here, we're kind of fiddling around with, does the, you know, does the front end look a bit sexier than the other guy, right? But then my question, I guess, is, right, despite all of this, or maybe, you know, this is the counterfactual that people need to understand. Like, in the US, you don't have this explosion of neobanks. You have a few. You have Mercury and, you know, a couple of others. But in the US, you're still cutting checks, like physical checks. So what does that tell you? It tells you, and yet the US is like the strongest economy on the planet. So if they don't need it, why do we?
Yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, I do think, you know, in some ways the US can be behind in some ways. So like, I remember, you know, when I was living in Brazil, we had chipped cards many years before the US ever did. Mm. And
so it was just magnetic stripes or whatever.
Yeah. And it was just a basic security thing. Yeah. But to your point, didn't really need it until it was that costly for banks.
I kind of go back and forth on this a lot because I mean, one of the ways I think about all of this is, how many new products do I need in my stack? And I last year, sort of November, December, I sat down and just looked at the stack that I use. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty simple. I use WhatsApp, Notion, Airtable, Gmail with Outlook, Google Sheets, and, you know, and the whole Google suite, I guess, Adobe, and Zoom, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe one or two kind of other little bits and pieces, and might be obviously my banks. I don't want anything additional. Like, I want stuff that plays in the space that I already operate in. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to keep adding new products and tools into my stack. And I just wonder whether, you know, I think my daughter probably has like 4 bank accounts, which would have been unheard of when I was growing up. Like, it was hard enough to get a Barclays account, right, at the time, or whatever it was. I shouldn't be rude to Barclays. I think they were all relatively similar. But the point is, like, okay, you've got this, you know, almost like playground where you can pick and choose kind of the bits that are valuable to you. So, you know, Wise offers better rates, or it's easier to deposit, so use them versus using, I don't know, Metro for your day-to-day usage versus Revolut for kind of operational versus JP Morgan for, you know, holding your cash in a secure place, right? Like, and the interesting thing is, bizarrely, I almost always recommend any of the companies that we work with, like, have a legacy bank in your stack, because you just don't know, right? And we saw it with SVB, and we saw it, you know, we saw what potentially could have happened if there was a, you know, knock-on effect of them shutting down. But you can't guarantee any of these things, right?
No, not at all.
Oh. So you want to make sure it's you know, it's safe where it is. So okay, so moving on to kind of I guess, you know, this is always an interesting question when I have guests on, right? Which is just about the overall VC landscape. So without preempting my final question, right? You've expressed concerns about kind of performative contrarianism and almost cartel-like mafiosi behaviors in the VC industry, right? Especially in the US. Mm-hmm. I don't think we see it as much in the UK, or haven't seen it as much in the UK as yet. How do you see those dynamics influencing the future of venture, and what can be done by all of us to foster a more genuine and productive investment environment?
Yeah, well, I think the way it's kind of manifesting itself publicly is sort of what I think people are referring to as the consolidation of VC.
Yeah.
You know, these large multi-billion dollar mega funds being raised. I mean, I think, what was it, like 75% of all VC dollars last year went to like a handful of funds. It was pretty staggering. And, you know, a few concerns there, because a lot of times those teams aren't proportionally scaling. So there's fewer person hours per company, and now they need to cut a lot more checks across a lot more stages. And I think that that's can lead to mean reversion. We've seen that over the history of VC. So that concerns me, because if we have that much capital consolidated under such a small number of people, them having sort of reign on those technology decisions concerns me, because I think there's a lot of smart VCs out there, but I don't think the heads of those firms are the people that should be making those ultimate decisions. And we saw that. I mean, Magic Leap, again, was like a great example of how that can go wrong very quickly. And that's completely avoidable if good work is done, rather than just trying to market the next round. And I think that's what it's devolving into in a lot of ways.
And is part of this, and we've seen, without naming names, and obviously I'm part of the problem here as well, but we've seen the kind of socialization of VC. 10 years ago, I don't think many people in the UK would have understood what venture capital was. Probably even now, like very few probably understand it particularly well. But they started getting an inkling of what it was in 2020, you know, when the UK government introduced the Future Fund, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, venture capital and venture capital-backed businesses were kind of on the agenda. In the US, obviously, you know, we've got a government or an incoming government that may be run slightly by proxy by, you know, a bunch of tech guys. I mean, like Elon, Vivek, Srinam, David Sachs, like... And let's not forget J.D. Vance, who is apparently the vice president, although I haven't heard from him in a while. But like, they're now really front and center of the conversation. And they already were on places like Twitter, on their podcasts, on Facebook, LinkedIn, wherever that might have been. But is that part of the problem? Like they've become so good at almost setting themselves up on this pedestal of, you know, we are the innovators. Well, actually, they're the capital providers more than the innovator. Like, is that what is happening? Is that where the problem is stemming from?
I think it just comes back to, actually, it's interesting, like memetics. And I mean, Peter Thiel talks about it, and so do a lot of his network. But I do think a lot of human nature is sort of monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they see success, they want to be a part of that. So, like, and you hear it from LPs, too. They're like, well, is Sequoia following your rounds?
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, here's this, like, self-fulfilling prophecy now. And that's going to be hard to break from, because, yeah, and the reality is, if people say it enough times, it kind of becomes true in the ether. People being founders of companies that they're not and stuff like that. I think that mythology breaks reality in a lot of ways and causes adverse decision making, when like this isn't about them and the mythology behind them. It's about making good, sober investment decisions. And, you know, and it's interesting at how socialized it's become, because, you know, I also like, I don't suggest having transactional interpersonal relationships, but I do think VC is inherently transactional. Like, there's no LP or fund manager that's talking to a founder or a manager, you know, just like for the fun of it.
Yeah.
They're talking because they're looking for an investment, a transaction.
There is a value exchange potentially going to happen. Yeah. That's what the whole business is. Yeah.
Yeah. And so once people start to be a little bit more realistic about that, I think then, you know, we can forget about the window dressing on a lot of this.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was speaking to a VC earlier today, actually, who basically said the same thing. Like, you know, we need to move away from the VC value add proposition. Like, he goes, you know, good VCs will be able to help. Great VCs will, you know, be able to help and maybe open some doors. And phenomenal VCs may be able to help open some doors and you know, give you guidance on the strategy or whatever, right? But ultimately, it's the founder that's creating the value. And you know, we've kind of had this almost head fake where it's felt for several years now that it's the VCs that make the business. When actually, yeah, no, okay, look, the VC has provided the capital. The question is always the counterfactual. Without that VC's funding, would that founder or that business have been successful? And what this particular VC said to me was, yes, they would have been successful. Maybe it would have taken them longer, or maybe maybe the exit would have been smaller or bigger, right? Like you don't know. But a truly great founder would make it whichever way. What's happened is the narrative has become all about the VC rather than the founder. And I guess the other, you know, point there, to your point, is that self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, you know, if you take money from Andreessen Horowitz, you're going to be successful. But actually, no one ever talks about the portfolio that didn't work, right? We only ever see the success stories, and therefore we just have survivor's bias over so much of it.
Yeah, and you know, a big problem right now, I've seen firsthand many times over right now with a lot of these mega funds is, I mean, they'll cut seed stage checks sometimes. That's purely an optionality check.
100%.
They're not going to give any founder the time of day. They're not really going to help them.
That 50K kind of first check.
Like, I've seen like $1 million checks and they're like, great, come back at Series B.
Yeah.
And founders are just like, wait, what? We thought we got to sort of ride the wave with you. And
yeah.
I think they get the wrong idea a lot of times. And I mean, that can send a negative signal and kill rounds in a lot of instances. So, you know, I think founders should be wary of it as well. And I think LPs need to get a little bit wiser about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, to your point there is this whole, you know, I speak to a lot of founders, and whilst no founder takes capital from a fund assuming that they will follow on, they kind of hope that they do. Because for no other reason than the negative signal that provides. So if you take that $1 million check from Andreessen at pre-seed, for argument's sake, and they don't invest at seed or maybe at Series A or whatever, then you're going to have, like, other investors are going to be asking that question. Well, you know, they came in early. Why aren't they coming in again? Like, if you're so great.
And, you know, and at the end of the day, you know, my view of it is it doesn't really matter that much, honestly. So it's like, why are we having this conversation to begin with? Like, feels like we're just navel gazing a whole lot.
That's So maybe the answer to this is good capital allocators allocate capital, great founders build, and like be happy with that setup.
Yeah, like I mean, like, you know, I think there's a lot. Like, I think VCs become very marketing heavy, creating these mythologies, and like,
yeah,
okay, fine, sure. You know, you can bend reality however you feel like, but at the end of the day, it's an investing job. And pretending like we're doing more than that is sort of silly.
Yeah, you might want to have a chat with the rest of the ecosystem. we should spread the word a little bit. Yeah. Okay. So look, finally, I mean, this is a question I've been asking pretty much every guest for the last several months, and the responses have been educative, to say the least. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is a hill that you would die in defending?
What is a hill I'd die and defend on? Man, there's a whole lot of them. This is a hard one. Can I have a second to think about that?
Yeah, please.
Okay, sorry. I had one in my mind. I'm forgetting about it now. Okay, here's one that's probably going to perk some people up. I don't think it makes any sense to send humans to Mars.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think it makes zero sense, especially if Tesla's got these great humanoid robots. Why aren't we planning on sending a bunch of those instead of, you know, a likely one-way ticket?
I mean, I agree. I mean, I think we should fix where we are before we start trying to colonize somewhere else, right?
Yeah, I mean, but also there's like, why do we need to send humans there? I mean, it's not like we're great at surviving in space for long durations or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's not like we're going to go beyond our solar system, because the second you're passive Van Allen belt, you're dead. Space is gonna kill you.
so why don't even take the first step?
Yeah. Well, it's not even to take the first step. It's just like, but we can do the same thing, but we don't need to send humans there. We got all these robotics coming up, and I think that could be, you know, a much more interesting path forward than, you know, what I think could be a very, very dangerous and risky mission.
But it is, going back to your point just before, it's a marketing ploy, right? Like, it just sounds amazing, sexy, like, you know, let's send people to Mars.
People get behind it.
People will get behind it, right? But without necessarily thinking about the why or the consequences of that either. I mean, like, I always think about it from, well, I say always, when I do think about it, which is rarely, the way I think about it is, okay, send people to Mars. We're in the process of destroying the planet we've lived on for millions and millions and millions, hundreds of millions of years. How long is it going to take us to do the same over there?
Yeah. I mean, whether or not we will destroy the planet or not, I don't know. I hope not. But at the end of the day, like, if we're talking about acceleration, which is, like, you know, everyone likes to talk about effective acceleration.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
A lot faster to send robots than it is humans, period. Like,
send a bunch of Mars rovers and we should be okay.
I mean, we're going to have a plethora of different kinds of amazing robots in the not too distant future. Like, I can do lots of amazing things. Like, there's just doesn't make sense to risk life for that.
How far, I mean, just a very side question, how far off from fully automated kind of manufacturing lines or warehousing do you think we are?
I mean, we have fully automated factories today of different types. You know, I don't know that it always makes sense to fully automate things. I mean, you automate where you can, where it makes sense, but I mean we're kind of there today already.
I guess so maybe to rephrase the question somewhat, like, where you just simply do not need human interaction.
I mean, a lot of manufacturing you just don't need human interaction. They're just small menial tasks. But I mean, I also think that about a lot of human tasks today. You know, I mean, obviously cooking. We've got a portfolio company, Kaikaku, who's building robotics, you know, for restaurants so that, you know, you can sort of produce consistently high quality food at speed. And, you know, you only need a couple of people running the entire shop and you can service.
You don't need a bunch of people chopping onions and cutting potatoes.
It's not a good use of their time. It's not a good use of the company's time. It's just,
I mean, this conversation, like, it's the same one as AI, right? Yeah. Like, it's exactly the same one in knowledge industry, right? And the question I always come back to is, okay, yes, you could have machines, whether that's software, whether that's hardware, doing these tasks. But part of the learning process to get to the higher levels of being in that example, you know, an excellent three Michelin star type chef is having gone through that process of learning, okay, when I cut an onion like this, the flavor comes out like that, but if I cut it finer, something else happens. Like, there is a learning outcome from the process of doing some of those menial tasks. And I think about it a lot in terms of, say, my industry or law, for example, where I wonder and I have a concern about, will we have enough people then coming through the system really learning from the ground up to be able to make those harder decisions further up the chain? And, like, how do we find that balance? I mean, I appreciate that that's a fairly complex and broad question, but that's the bit where I'm not sure about, you know, does it make sense to stop humans from doing some of these tasks altogether?
I completely appreciate what you're saying. And I think it kind of comes down to the individual, honestly, because, you know, you can go into any high school in the United States and you'll find students that are just learning the algorithms to get a good grade on a test. And then there's kids that are actually learning the fundamentals behind how, you know, to solve that particular problem. And so, like, I think of AI as, like, all right, if you want to shortcut it, go ahead, use AI. You're going to shortcut the learning. But if you want to fundamentally understand how these things work, you still have to get hands-on.
Yeah. You use it, but you don't let it replace you. You essentially, you use it to learn faster and or more than others, and that will set you up.
And I think there's lots of great examples of that today, you know, with like professional poker and chess players training with AI. And, you know, I mean, I'm not professional in any of those fields, but, you know, generally, I think they've said it's helped them step up the level of competition.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it allows you the opportunity to have more. Well, I mean, it's essentially more bats, right? Like it's more time at base, right? You are able to test yourself against hundreds or thousands of potential competitors in poker, for argument's sake, or mm-hmm. different profiles of competitors versus, okay, I can only play with a human being. Therefore, there is a limit to the number of different phenotypes of person that I'm going to play against in the real world. Jeff, this has been a very wide-ranging, interesting, and enjoyable conversation. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can they find you on the internet?
Yeah, 7% Ventures, 7pc.vc mm-hmm. is our website. On Twitter and LinkedIn, can find me pretty active on either of those sites.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a massive pleasure.
Great. Thank you.